ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day there, my name's Matt Brand. Welcome to the program. We've got an update today on the bird flu outbreak in America's dairy herd and whether Australia should be concerned or not.
As farmers struggle with poor farm gate prices, sometimes it can be hard to maintain very good biosecurity practices.
Speaking of biosecurity, members of the Territory's cattle industry were put through a mock scenario yesterday to see how they'd deal with an emergency animal disease outbreak. How did they go? What was learnt? And when will this training be made available to others? You'll find out today on the Country Hour. We are broadcasting right across the Territory on the ABC, and g'day to those who have tuned in via the podcast. First up today, let's talk about cotton.
Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from? Cotton Eye Joe.
New varieties of cotton are being trialled right here in the Northern Territory, and it's hoped they'll go on to help growers get better yields and also keep weeds at bay. Now, these new varieties have what's known as the ExtendFlex trait, which has been developed over the last 10 years and has now been tested at the Douglas Daily Research Farm. Angus Marshall is an agronomist for Cotton Seed Distributors. He had a chat to Jan Kahoot about this trial.
The new varieties that CSD will be looking at releasing in the coming years, so they are basically the outcome of the last 10 years of breeding. So our breeders down at CSIRO in Narrabri have been working on these varieties for 10 years. So, we're currently testing these varieties in the north this year. This is the first time we had them, so and then we'll be comparing them to the varieties we've got now. But, yeah, these varieties are looking really promising. They're going to have improvements in terms of yield, fibre quality, disease packages, as well as the ExtendFlex traits, which is the ability to be able to apply more herbicides over the top of these cotton to control some of the problematic weeds we have up here.
What kind of problematic weeds do you reckon they'll control the best?
So a big thing will be resistant grasses. So, we have grasses that are currently resistant to some herbicides, so it's a tool in the toolbox to be able to control some of those grasses will be a big one, but there's a lot of other broadleafs, broadleaf weeds and things like that that these herbicides will be able to control.
What about in terms of insects? Has it got any resistance towards that?
So these varieties still have what we call the Bolgard 3 insect package. The insect package hasn't changed, so they still have the three Bolgard proteins that these plants produce. Yeah.
Has it been trialled elsewhere except from the Northern Territory?
Yeah, so we've been fortunate enough to be able to trial these varieties for about the past 4 years down in the southern growing valleys, so that's southern Queensland and northern New South Wales. These varieties have been tested for a number of years and have performed really, really well. So we're quite confident that these varieties will be another step up in terms of cotton production.
And when will they be made available for growers to test out?
So these varieties will be available in the coming season. So what we'll have basically a rollout of these new varieties. The uptake of the new varieties and the speed we change over into these new varieties will be determined by the industry. So how popular these varieties will be in the next coming season.
What's the biggest challenge you've seen for growers in the Northern Territory, and how do you think those varieties in particular will help?
Yeah, so there's a number of challenges we face up here in the Northern Territory, and a big one is establishment, so getting the cotton out of the ground in a timely and consistent manner. So, you know, with the variable rainfall we see throughout December where we want to start planting, you know, we can have some fields that may not come up as well, but we have some varieties that will establish really well. Another problem we also have up in the Territory is the availability of sunlight. We saw, you know, some pretty big monsoonal conditions hang around this year for a number of weeks where we didn't see sunlight. You know, nearly all of January was basically cloudy. So, we have a variety of what's called an okra leaf. So The best way to explain that, it's a very narrow leaf. It looks a bit funny when you see it in the field. It doesn't really look like a normal cotton plant. But so in theory, what we're thinking with that is there'll be more light interception down into the plant, you know, to be able to combat some of those restrictions on solar radiation.
Okay. There's been a lot of trouble with water logging, a lot of the plants. Are the varieties going to help with any of that?
They won't grow better in waterlogged conditions. They may yield a little bit better just because of their potential, but I guess they're not aimed at suiting waterlogged conditions better. This year was quite unique in the amount of rainfall that we saw across the areas that are growing cotton. So it'll be pretty rare for the events that have occurred this season to happen in the next couple of years, I think. Yeah.
Any more upcoming research that's currently in the works for cotton?
Yeah, so there's a lot of research going on at the moment. We're here at the Douglas Daily Research Farm, and these guys are doing a great job investigating all sorts of issues. Like we talked about establishment, so we're trying to improve establishment with cover crops. So the idea of a cover crop is to have some sort of mulch on the ground when you plant into the country, hopefully to reduce soil temperature and retain moisture for a little bit longer. There's a lot of research going into nutrition and nutrition efficiency, applied nutrition efficiency. And then, as we go on, as we understand how cotton grows in the north a little bit more, there'll be more and more research projects underway in the coming years.
That's Angus Marshall, who's an agronomist for Cottonseed Distributors. These new varieties, along with some other cotton trials, were on show this week as part of a field day in the Douglas Daily. Andrew Parks, he was there. He is a veteran of Australia's cotton industry and Managing Director of Customised Farm Management. He says there's a lot of important cotton research happening at the moment in the north.
Yeah, look, the trial today is multiple, so there's a lot of different things being looked at, which is great. So far, we've already sort of seen some plant density trials with cotton, which with a cotton crop is important to establish and understand how it reacts to different climates in terms of how close it is planted to each other. So it will react differently in different environments to how close to its neighbour it is, and it's really good to get an understanding of that sort of stuff up here. Nutrition trials are being conducted as well. We also just had a quick look at a systems trial, so farming systems. What is ultimately going to be the farming system that helps support things like cotton? So it's not necessarily just the cotton crop. What other crops do we grow in rotation and in conjunction and alongside the cotton crop to ensure we've got the proper and the right farming system over time? So they're things we've looked at. We're looking at some more nutrition trials and some variety trials, one of those on rain-fed and one of those irrigated, which again is really important and interesting to see, because the different varieties we do have available to us do again react to different climates.
And so you've been growing cotton in Douglas Daily. How's it all looking currently?
Yeah, look, this is our second year up here of growing the cotton. It's been another challenge. The 2 years we've grown the crop so far have been unbelievably different in how the season has panned out. So it's been challenging again. We've got some crop that we're hopeful will be around about our target yield. So we're aiming to hit that 5 bale to the hectare level. That's commercially viable and financially viable for us. I don't think we'll average that this season because of some of those challenges that we've gone through. But we're getting close, so it won't be long and we'll actually know what that answer is.
So you said it's been very different years. What's been the main challenge this year?
Oh, look, the main challenge this year in complete opposition to last year was this year we got a bit of a false start to the wet. Late October, early to mid-November were quite wet where we were. We had some really good rainfall events and then it stopped for about 4 to 5 weeks. We did plant some cotton into that period of time because we learnt last year that we can't plant too late, into mid-January, for example. So we wanted to start early, and we did. But due to that, we lost some hectares due to the seed shooting on the rainfall we did get, but then not having enough rainfall to properly establish it, and so it just dried out and died out. Once the season did start, however, much more towards the back end of December, as is typical, it didn't stop. So then it was difficult for actually get the crop in the ground. And certainly January and February this year, there was very little gap in between any of the rainfall. There was very little sunlight that, you know, all plants need to a degree, but particularly cotton needs it to support what it's producing. So it was really difficult then to do our operations on the crops, to do the, you know, the herbicide applications and the growth regulant applications we do to the crop. We didn't have the ability to do that because it basically rained every day. And it also supported the crop not having that sunshine. It did lose a lot of its fruit. So the bowls, the early fruit flowers and small bowls that become the big bowls at the end, they aborted during that you know, long periods of cloud and wet weather.
How much yield are you anticipating to get out of this year's work?
Yeah, so look, we're hoping for a 3.5 to 4 bale average this year. I think one of the impacts, besides the ones I've already mentioned, is also that because of the so much consistent rainfall, we've actually got a lot of crop missing in paddocks. So paddocks that we've actually kept, there's still holes in them where the water has laid for way too long. It's got too hot and it's basically cooked the plants. So it's really hard to take all that into account at this point, where we're hoping for that 3.5 and maybe to 4 and a little bit above. We'd be really happy if we got to that point given this season.
In terms of research, what would you like the government to look into to mitigate those challenges that you come across?
Oh, look, you know, there is so much research that is needed up here. It's sort of not funny. A lot of the issue we currently have is it actually relates to managing the resistance that, you know, a lot of people are aware of occurred many, many years ago in this environment when cotton was first grown. And that's a totally different issue today to what it was back then. We don't use the pesticides we used back then. So, but the resistance management plan that we currently are working to here is adopted from a different region. And it doesn't really necessarily suit exactly how the best way to grow the crop is up here. So we need to adapt that resistance management plan to suit this environment a whole heap better, to allow us to be able to then grow the bigger crops and the bigger yields. So the research that needs to be done in and around that to make sure whatever move we make or whatever change we suggest should occur to that resistance management plan needs to be understood, and what the ramifications of that move might be has to be understood before we make the change. There's no use making that change and it being wrong and we end up with a resistance issue. Not that it would happen that fast, but that's the concern. So there's all sorts of research that comes along with that. One of the key things that I'm really keen to try and find out is what does the non-cotton or non-farming areas in this region provide in terms of insect dilution? There's millions of hectares up here that sit in and around the cotton growing regions. So what are the insects that are out there do in terms of diluting any potential resistant individuals that we might have in a cotton crop? That sort of question is, you know, probably takes years of research, but it's critical for us to understand what it does provide so that we make sure we don't end up with resistance, but we get the best resistance management plan adapted for this crop as soon as we can.
That's Andrew Parks, who heads up the Moree-based Customised Farm Management. That company's involved in cotton production there at Black Bull Station in the Douglas Daly region. It's getting near the business end of the season for cotton producers. We're told some harvests will get underway next month at the back end of May.
Hello, my name is Sarah. I'm a third-year student studying at Animal Science Faculty, Universitas Gajah Mada. I'm now currently at the Northern Territory for the Indonesia Northern Territory Biosecurity Program. And now you're listening to The Country Hour.
Members of the Territory's cattle industry were put through a mock scenario yesterday to see how they deal with an emergency animal disease outbreak. This was all part of a biosecurity training program that will hopefully be rolled out across the Territory in the coming months. To learn more about it, I had a chat to NTCA Biosecurity Liaison Officers, Senny Hussey and Jess Daniels.
So we're working under a contract called the Northern Australian Coordination Network. It's a federally funded cross-jurisdictional program. So we're working with Queensland and WA as well as the Northern Territory government. And the aim of the training is to help producers be more prepared in the event of an emergency animal disease incursion.
And it's sort of early days for this program. You actually ran a bit of a pilot training program yesterday. Tell me about that.
So we ran a pilot yesterday. We selected a few key personnel from a range of operations through industry. And the idea is that once we get this training finalised, we're going to go and roll it out to all of the industry, all of the pastoral. And on its success, we hope that Queensland and Northern WA will also adapt and roll it out. So everyone's getting the same training right across the north. And in the event of an incursion, we can all work together and we have the same training and knowledge to react to a disease incursion. The pilot yesterday went really well. We had lots of feedback, which was great. It's what we were after. Mm-hmm. So there's a few things we need to go back and tweak and finalise. And then hopefully we will start rolling training out to broader industry by the end of next month.
So in case something awful did happen down the track, the idea is to almost upskill the industry. In preparation, yeah? That's what we're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So industry practices are already great. We are just trying to provide as much information, as much training as possible to help all pastoralists be prepared, think about their biosecurity plans, think about what might happen in an incursion, and to allow them to try and build more resilient businesses to help us all get through an incursion if one was to occur.
And so is it easy to explain to us what type of, topics or workshops were part of that pilot yesterday?
Yeah, so we talked through a mock scenario at the start of the training just to try and bring some relevance, I guess, to the training and have people start to think about if an emergency animal disease incursion did happen on my property, what would that look like for me? What are the potential issues that might come up on my property that might not come up on somebody else's property? What different things do we have to think about? And then we sort of rolled through how are decisions made? What does emergency control centre look like? What legislation supports both the producers and the government to make decisions and make sure that things are being done the way that we've been trained to do them, and how does the communication happen?
There's so many moving parts. I looked at that A4 document. I mean, it's because it's not just the station. It's the export yards. It's the boat that's anchored up at Darwin Port. There's just so many parts to it, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And we're trying to make these scenarios as real life as possible. Mm. And these are the things that are going to happen. We need to think about the transport operators. We need to think about the contractors and how we're going to get fodder in and out. And all of these things, it's not just so much about the animals in the incursion.
Was there any aha light bulb moments yesterday?
I don't know particularly an aha moment, but we did a bit of a survey with everyone at the end, and mm-hmm. and everyone said that they left knowing far more than they knew when they arrived in regards to what would happen in the immediate time after an incursion if it was to happen.
Which is good. And also, I guess, people just having a bit of confidence that there is a plan in place.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Knowing what that would look like.
Yeah, and I think that's a real key part of what we're trying to do is get everyone familiar with the legislation and with what might happen in peacetime so they can think about it. You know, we encourage these guys to message us or to let us know as they've thought about things on their drive home or they're thinking about things in the paddock today, more stuff that we can add in, maybe information that we haven't thought about that's really important to industry. And we're just trying to provide as much as we can to assist industry to be as best prepared as possible.
It's like most stations would probably have it in their mind what they'd do if someone got bitten by a brown snake out in the paddock. This is just something else.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the pilot's been done. Tell us again, when would you be hoping to roll this out to industry, if all goes to plan?
So we got a fair amount of feedback yesterday, which was great. That's exactly what we were hoping for. Our plan is to start rolling that out in May. what that looks like exactly, we're not sure at the moment. Obviously, with a late and a fairly heavy wet, a lot of people are only just starting first round now or haven't quite got started yet. There's still a lot of roads that we can't move cattle on. So our timelines generally for this time of year are pretty shortened across the territory this year. And we always want to make sure that we're going to provide our training at a time that's best for producers. So we'll just sort of work through that over the next few weeks, make some changes to the presentation, and then look at where people are at with first round, with flood recovery and that sort of thing, and try and lock some dates in from there.
And then hopefully it spreads across into the other jurisdictions. An interesting project. Thanks for telling us about it on the Country Hour, and I assume to anyone listening who wants to know more, get in contact with the NT Cattlemen's Association.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having us.
That's Senny Hussey and Jess Daniels, who are biosecurity liaison officers with the NT Cattlemen's Association, telling you about this program. It's called the Industry Biosecurity Response Readiness Training Program. Quick update now on the Barkly Highway. The 13-axle restriction on that road, which has been in place for weeks, was lifted at 6 o'clock this morning. This is good news. So this means triple road trains are now allowed to travel on the Barkly Highway. This has been a long time coming, but it's now open. The Department of Infrastructure is still recommending high clearance four-wheel drives for the Barkly Highway and says single lane closures remain in place and is asking motorists to reduce their speed and just drive to the conditions. The poor old Barkly Highway has copped an absolute battering this wet season. Also, if you're travelling along the Stuart Highway near Noonamar today, just be aware of smoke because Bushfires NT is conducting a planned burn. So smoke from that fire may affect visibility. Firefighting crews may be working close to the road. So again, please slow down and drive to the conditions.
G'day, my name is Floyd. Yeah, I work in the Spanish mackerel fishery and in the Gulf of Carpentaria. I love what I do and love my job, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Matt Brown with you this afternoon. We've got an update for you today on the bird flu outbreak in America's dairy herd and whether Australia should be concerned or not. And we'll be talking about Wagyu again, one of my favourite topics. Our story last week has generated a lot of conversation online. We put up a picture of the award-winning Grand Champion Wagyu steak. And, well, people either said, yummy, I'm so hungry. But a lot of people went, yuck, look at all the fat on it. I'd rather eat my own boot. The Wagyu industry is very aware of these type of comments. What's it doing to educate the public on the difference between fat and Wagyu fat? We'll talk about this in a moment. Let's go to the Weather Bureau. Rebecca Patrick is there this afternoon. Beck, tell us about the prospects of a tropical cyclone this weekend.
Yeah, good afternoon, Matt. At the moment, we are keeping an eye on an area just the southern end of Papua in the northeast Arafura Sea. At this stage, we're just looking at that area where the trough is to see if a low might be forming. In the next couple of days, that trough and potential low is expected to move a little bit further south. And so at this stage, there's a moderate chance of further development, which is only 25%. That's on Saturday. Most likely staying offshore. And probably if it does form, it will be pretty short-lived as conditions are expected to be a bit unfavourable for further development as we go through Sunday, Monday. So it's just a bit of a short risk period over Saturday where we do have that moderate risk level, but then a decreasing risk after that.
Okay. And people can do this themselves if they like. Go on the Bureau's website and look for the tropical cyclone forecast. And you can see this low potentially turning into a cyclone, as you said, Rebecca, but then kind of if it's going anywhere, it sort of forecast to head further north, not towards the coast. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the next 24 hours, it might move a bit further south, but not anywhere near the coast at this stage, and then move west to northwest over the coming days.
What could it mean in terms of potential rainfall for the territory?
Yeah, well, if it's staying to the north, there's actually drier air coming around on the southwestern side of that, which means drier air pushing through the territory. It's looking like not increasing rainfall too much at all. Maybe some places around the northeast Arnhem coast could see a little bit more, but certainly if you're away from those areas, not expecting too much rainfall at all over the next week, really.
There's been a bit of rain in the 24-hour period to 9 o'clock this morning.
Yeah, so we have seen some rainfall to 9 a.m. Cape Wessel, right in the top northeast corner, has recorded 68 millimetres. Dumman Miri to the southwest of Darwin, 54 millimetres. Bachelor, 40 millimetres, so a little bit around the place over the last 24 hours due to some storms that formed up yesterday afternoon over the Arnhem District and then moved westwards overnight.
Mm.
So a little bit of rain around the place at the moment. Just looking at the radar, there's not too much going on, mainly around the coastal areas, although I'm seeing just a few showers south of Katherine as well this afternoon.
And what about the next few days for those in Central Australia and the Barkly?
Yeah, in the southern parts of the territory, with just seeing those continued dry, windy conditions for the next few days and through the weekend as well. So sunny skies and windy conditions continuing. In terms of temperatures, Alice Springs getting up to 27, though those temperatures might fall a little bit across the weekend, getting down to 24 over the weekend. Yallara looking at maintaining pretty much 26, 27 degrees for the next few days. And Tennant Creek staying in the high 20s over the weekend, so dropping just a few degrees as well from today's forecast of 32.
Thanks for your time this afternoon.
No worries. Thanks, Matt.
That's Rebecca Patrick there at the Weather Bureau. It is 10 past one. You are tuned into the Country Hour. Just before the 1 o'clock news, we were talking about the NTCA's biosecurity program, the official title, the Industry Biosecurity Response Readiness Training Program. Got a text here from someone who says one of the most important tools in an exotic disease outbreak is ensuring the NLIS scheme is working and is working nationally to record and read all movements of stock. Its integrity is currently compromised as some states are not requiring cattle tags to be read for all movements. There's someone here on 0487 99 1057 on the topic of biosecurity. Up next, we'll get the latest on the bird flu outbreak in the US dairy herd.
Hi, I'm Jake Stringer. I'm the manager of Kidman Spring Station, and you're listening to The Country Hour.
Yeah, so the global beef industry is keeping a very close eye on this bird flu outbreak in the US dairy herd. The latest numbers we've got is that dairy cows in 26 herds across 8 states have now tested positive to avian influenza, and there's a push on to actually rename this bovine flu. Honorary professor with the Australian National University, Robin Alders, says she's not surprised about the quick spread through the dairy herd and warns that Australia needs to be prepared.
I suspect this is not unexpected given the connectivity of dairy herds in the US and the stickiness of the influenza virus. So animals can be carrying it. It's also very easily transported as fomites, meaning the virus will attach to inanimate objects or to human people in our shoes and move around. So that's the, you know, the thing that we know about the influenza virus. And we've had a recommendation from the chapter of bovine veterinarians in the US that the current outbreak be designated as bovine influenza. In terms of formal global recognition, that's a decision that would have to be made by the OFLU network, which is a group of animal influenza specialists at the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations and the World Organization for Animal Health, and they are yet to make their position on that recommendation known.
So to a certain extent, do you think it's partly because they don't want to panic people that this flu is not as bad in cattle as it is in birds?
There may well be that element. I suspect that would be coming more from the industry side. What we know is in countries where there have been outbreaks of avian influenza in chickens, it does cause a huge impact on the marketing of poultry products. So it may be that. I do believe that in terms of the bovine practitioners, their interest is in helping their members understand about the new clinical picture, and that they think that a change in name may actually help them with better recognition, that it will jump into their head much more quickly.
At last count, or the last time I looked, 17 states have restricted cattle importation from states where the virus is known to have infected the dairy cows. What's the likelihood of more serious quarantine restrictions being introduced?
I think that's going to depend on impacts on productivity and the potential where you may also have states with very high density of poultry production units. So it's going to be about limiting the spread of this new clade, this new strain, so that they'll be very concerned about that. It's not just about looking at movement of animals. For those people who remember the equine influenza outbreak in Australia, the big spread of that virus outside the stables where it originated was movement with people and not with the animal. You know, they're going to have to do their risk assessment to just see what is going to be possible and feasible to minimise spread given the interconnectedness of the industries across the different states.
As an Australian-based researcher, what is sparking your interest about what's happening over there? Is there anything we need to know in Australia about what's going on?
I think absolutely people will be very interested about how the strain entered those herds, how did it spread within the herd. So there's still, you know, we're still not completely clear, really, is it the virus that's causing this illness? Is it there as a co-infection? And how did it enter? Did it come in through water, through feed contaminated with bird droppings? All of these things, we still don't understand how it's moving around. We do know a lot about the influenza virus and how to control it. Our big problem, I think, as we see the spread within these intensive industries, and it's the same on the poultry side, where we have these rapid spreads, it's where you've got very large flocks or very large herds and rapid movement of animals and animal-associated people or equipment that's moving between these. So we're going to have to think about, are there upper limits, you know, on what a flock or a herd size should be? Do we need to think about really having geographical areas that we think are more suitable? So away from areas with waterfowl, for instance. I think there's a lot of things that our animal health professionals will be taking great care to look at, to learn, and also to work with industry. Because clearly industry here, they're worried about animal welfare, they're worried about productivity, so that everybody that has a stake in this is involved. The more information that we can have that's shared, the better prepared we're going to be.
And do you think Australia, just by the nature of its huge geographical spread and the fact that we don't have as bigger intensive agricultural farming as the US, that we could be in a better place, let's say?
Not, I guess I would say not necessarily. As we saw with the equine influenza outbreak in Australia, horse movement was locked down very quickly, but the virus still travelled. And while we are a very big country and maybe with a few major players, we have air travel, and often with those big industries, we actually have a small support base of very senior professional people that may move between those farms, looking at all of this, doing our risk assessment, and just practicing good hygiene, good biosecurity on the farms, good hygiene for people. And that's really what we need to do. But what I would say is also, as farmers struggle with poor farm gate prices, sometimes it can be hard to maintain very good biosecurity practices. In my opinion, the discussion we're having about farm gate payments to producers is a really important, and it's not just about their immediate economic survival. It's about them being able to do the best thing in terms of biosecurity and animal welfare.
Honorary Professor with ANU's Development Policy Centre, Robin Alders, speaking there to Emma Field. Reuters is reporting that dairy farmers in the US are raising their defences to try and contain the spread of bird flu or bovine flu by banning visitors, cutting down trees on their farms to discourage wild birds from actually landing, and disinfecting vehicles coming onto their property. From what I can tell, cattle prices at the sale yards haven't been too affected by this in the US, but the live cattle futures price has taken a significant hit in the last week or so. It's 20 past one. You are tuned into the Country Hour. If you listened to the program last week, we spent a fair bit of time talking about Wagyu. The Wagyu branded beef awards were held. The steak that took out the grand champion prize was quite an incredible piece of beef. It had 60% marbling, 60%. We put a picture of it up on the ABC Landline Facebook page. About 1,000 comments on it at the moment. And the response is mixed, I think it's fair to say. For example, Stuart says, whoa, are they feeding these cows KFC and VBs? There's a lot of people like Kim who say, oh, would be absolutely beautiful to eat this. Juicy, yum. Esther says, nice Wagyu, I bet it's expensive. But then you've got people who aren't too sure about this. Valerie says, whoa, that does not look very nice to me. And McGill says, that's the most disgusting steak that I've ever seen. Gross. Well, Maeve Webster is the president of Menu Matters, a US food service consultancy business. And she says Americans obviously love their hamburgers, but getting them to appreciate and understand Wagyu is a challenge. She spoke about her research with Bridget Herman.
What we found was there is a disconnect in part between consumers and operators. Operators are very familiar with the category. They're very educated, this set of operators. They really do understand country of origin, the marble scores, and everything. They're overestimating, however, the understanding among their patrons. Patrons are aware of Wagyu, but beyond that have very limited knowledge.
Why is that a concern?
Well, when you think about how to then discuss Wagyu, to describe Wagyu, and then ultimately to support higher costs for Wagyu to the consumer, they need to understand why it's worth that price. They need to understand what they're going to get out of paying that amount of money, whether it's actually in food service or in retail.
You spoke a bit about the amount of fat that can be on a cut of Wagyu and how the average American consumer perceives that. And it's a little bit different to how Australians perceive it. What did you find?
So Americans are terrified of fat, basically, is where we kind of landed. They appreciate the experience you get from good marbling, the buttery texture, the silky texture, and the flavor that goes along with it. But when they actually see the fat, they remember all of the messaging that fat's bad for you and fat's horrible. Plus, with anything where it's intermuscular fat deposits, from an American point of view, those are considered waste, money that they're spending for something that they're not actually going to eat. And so that becomes problematic as well. So there is that tension, right? The good and the bad with fat.
You just touched on it earlier, but Americans are tending to eat Wagyu out of their homes in restaurants. Why is that?
They're terrified of wasting the money by ruining the meat. To be honest with you, Americans, especially younger Americans, have very limited experience with preparing food away from home or preparing food at home. So they're only just beginning to learn how to do it. Something like Wagyu, which is going to cost a lot of money and often be for a special occasion. They don't want to ruin that special occasion. They don't want to waste the money by ruining the product.
And looking at both a consumer and an operator point of view now, how does Aussie Wagyu compared to Japanese Wagyu?
Oh, from a consumer perspective point of view, they right now they're really associating Wagyu with Japan. So if they hear Wagyu, they almost assume it's from Japan or just, you know, it's Japanese. So they're not necessarily against Australia Wagyu, but they don't really understand that Wagyu comes, it's a breed. It can come from anywhere. It's not Kobe, which is very specifically location associated, right? So I think that there's that element of education that definitely needs to happen, and that should come from better identification on the menu, broader marketing campaigns, which is certainly why we started this research, so that the messaging can be more impactful, reach the consumers, and then they'll start appreciating the broader availability of Wagyu from outside Japan.
From what you were saying, Wagyu doesn't have to necessarily always be that top-tier luxury product. It's actually got a place kind of in other areas of the meat market too. Can you tell me more about that?
Absolutely. So Wagyu right now is in the early stages as a trend, and it is living more often at the higher end. However, as Wagyu continues to grow, it will inevitably broaden into the mass market. As it broadens into the mass market, it will have to have a wider variety of options available to hit more price points and be accessible to more people. Where we are already seeing operators like Arby's, which is a quick service restaurant in the U.S. focused on sandwiches. They have already featured a promotion of Wagyu Burger. They're ahead of the line, essentially, right now. But I think we'll see more and more of that. So, of course, as that happens, Arby's can't afford a marble score of 9+ product. They're definitely going to be looking at some of the lower end on the marble score in order to make it accessible to their customers. So I think that as the market expands, there are going to be a lot of opportunities.
That is Maeve Webster, who runs a food service consultancy business in America, speaking to Bridget Herman. On the text, Russell says, I really dislike it when the menu says Wagyu I fillet and it comes out with no marbling, but it comes with the price tag, says Russell. Too right. That's it for today's Country Hour. Keep it rural.